Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Massachusetts has high quality but painfully expensive childcare, according to a new national report. So we'll talk to local childhood experts on whether it's time to revolutionize how the state funds pre-K education. Also, Hillary Clinton is in New Hampshire today. Political reporter Anthony Brooks tells us why the Granite State could decide the election. And Julie Lindahl went searching for the truth about her family's history. She found it in an 80-year-old man.
The thing that was very hard to learn was that the scar over his eye was actually as a result of my grandfather beating him when he was a kid, because he hadn't removed his cap when the SS passed by him. So if you were a Pole, you had to lift your cap when the SS passed. He looked me hard in the eye and said, "You know, this wasn't your fault, so you have to let go of that."
It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When it comes to childcare, Massachusetts ranks high on quality and availability, near the top of all states. But it's also at the top when it comes to cost. Child care is more expensive in this state than almost anywhere else. That's according to a report out today from the D.C.-based New America Foundation. Now, I know what you're thinking. No big surprise here. But think about this. It is possible that the child care market isn't working, or maybe isn't working as well as it could, because it's not a traditional market at all. It's actually part of the overall K-12 education market. At least that's how the New America Foundation looks at it. And therefore, like the rest of public education, should early child care receive substantial public investment? Or does that just sound like more big government spending to you? Well, joining us now with more is Nan Mooney. She authored a Massachusetts case study that's part of the New America Foundation's care report, and she joins us from Washington. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, first of all, Nan, I wonder, if you could just tell us how you believe or you thought that Massachusetts distinguishes itself in either good or bad ways from the rest of the country when it comes to child care.
Well, I'll frame that by saying we looked at all the states, and there are no states that are performing on all levels that are strong in availability, quality, and cost. So relative to other states, Massachusetts is actually doing pretty well. As you mentioned, they do well with quality and availability. And where we're really coming up against some tough stuff is with the cost. The cost is very high in Massachusetts. The average cost for full-time in-care center in a center is $13,208. And then for an infant, that's the most expensive care, $16,682. So those are big numbers. Those are hard numbers for a family to get their minds around and get their wallets around. And then if you have more than one child, of course, then you're doubling that. So and another big problem that came up, and again, this isn't just Massachusetts, this happens everywhere in the country, is the wages for the child care workers are very, very low.
Right.
So you have compromised care in that way. It's hard to keep teachers, and it's hard to get new people to come into the field when the wages are that low. So that's another big problem that's happening in Massachusetts.
And just to put another number out there, I mean, when you consider the average cost of child care in all its forms in Massachusetts, the New America Foundation came up with an even higher number, $21,000, right?
Right. Well, we looked primarily at the child care centers and the teachers who are working in these centers who are funded in part by federal subsidies. And that's a big portion of the child care expenses in the child care market, both in Massachusetts and across the country. And those subsidies are so low that it often make it very difficult for the child care centers to keep afloat. And that is one of the reasons that then subsequently the pay to the teachers is so low. It's becoming a big problem in Massachusetts for one reason, because the employment rate is so high, the unemployment rate is low, that really these teachers do have other better options and are moving on. So many of the child care facilities are finding it difficult to even keep their classrooms fully staffed with qualified teachers.
Well, so here's where the conflict sort of rests, right? Because in Massachusetts, we have one of the highest accreditation rates for early child care in the country. Accessibility, as we've talked about, is pretty good. Obviously, not perfect everywhere in the state, but pretty good. But it's those two things. And I think the state of Massachusetts has recognized the importance of early childhood education. So they've asked these centers to do quite a lot, keeping child-teacher rates, ratios at certain ratios, things like that. Everything that we've done to recognize how important early childhood care is are also the things that would drive the costs up, right? Because, you need teachers, you need people to do this. And that's what's making it even harder for people who have to pay those costs. So how do you find your way out of that conundrum?
Well, that's exactly right. And I don't think anyone's proposing a solution where we try to make childcare cheaper overall, because exactly what you said, you can't cut back on any of those things. And in fact, we need to start beginning to pay those teachers more, which is going to drive up the costs even further. I think what, on a policy level, where we need to be looking is how do we direct more money in that direction? And I think, again, as you mentioned earlier, looking at something more similar to how we fund our public education is going to be more helpful, instead of saying, oh, we're going to try and squeeze more money out of the parents because they don't have any more.
Mm. Well, so what would you say then to the person whose response to that is, well, the state already heavily, almost, fully subsidizes K through 12 education. If you ask the state to pay up more for, kids who are 2, 3, 4, A, we can't afford it, and B, at what point in time, we should expect parents to carry some responsibility for the early care of their children?
Well, I don't think we're saying that the parents would carry no responsibility, but this is more than, for so many years, this has been sort of pegged as this is a mommy's issue or a soft issue, but people are coming to realize that this is an incredibly critical economic issue, because we're looking at how can parents work if they are not able to have good quality, accessible childcare to leave their children at, right? If they don't have childcare at all, or if they're having to kind of dash out and patchwork things at the last minute. So it's affecting today's workforce. And of course, as I mentioned, there's just been all this research about what's happening with children's brains when they're at this age. You can't just dump them with just anyone. I mean, they're making critical educational leaps at this age that they need to be with someone who has some sort of background in early education, and that this is your future workforce. So we really need to invest, just like we said, we need to invest in educating children, starting at age 5. We also need to push that investment earlier.
But nevertheless, you called Massachusetts as relying on a patchwork and on patchwork and Band-Aids in order to survive when it comes to child care. What exactly did you mean by that? These sort of smaller programs across the state?
I think that's what it feels like for many of the providers, certainly of the many of the providers I spoke to, that they are having to make budget cuts where they really don't have anything left to cut, and they're having to go to the community and go to nonprofits and try to raise nickel and dime, raise any money they can to keep themselves afloat. And where they're often having to cut is in the benefits they're giving the teachers, and as we discussed, there just isn't room to cut
right
there. So there needs to be another source of funding, and where that funding most logically would come from is federal and state subsidies.
Well, Nan Mooney is author of a case study on child care in Massachusetts. It was part of a big new report published today about child care across this country, published by the New America Foundation, and she joined us from Washington. Nan Mooney, thanks so much.
Thank you, Magma.
Well, let's turn now to a local perspective on this. It comes from Joanne Roberts. She's senior research scientist at the Work, Families, and Children Research Group at the Wellesley Centers for Women. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So you heard what Nan Mooney had to say. I'm curious. I mean, help us understand in a little bit more detail. What do you think are the biggest cost drivers in Massachusetts when it comes to our very high cost, average cost of childcare here?
Right. Well, Massachusetts has some of the strictest licensing regulations in the country, and that's particularly true related to group size and child staff ratio. So that really drives cost. It's staffing is the number one cost to programs. And when group sizes are low and ratios are low, it drives up cost. But in addition to that, it also improves quality.
Right. So that's that conundrum that I was talking about before with Nan Mooney. How do we work our way out of it? We want the highest quality early child care for the children of Massachusetts.
Exactly. So I really actually think the way to begin looking at this issue is really to change our question. The question should not be, how do you make childcare more affordable? It really needs to be, how do you make childcare more affordable without sacrificing quality? Mm-hmm. And we really have to think of those dual perspectives. Childcare is a unique market in that it needs to support families and working, but it also needs to support children in learning. And those don't often work well together when you're thinking of cost.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm wondering what the tools are available for us to reach that goal, because, you know, for example, there already is a child care tax credit available for people. I mean, I think there's a pretty solid argument to be made that the tax credit may not help enough, but it's there. I mean, are there other policy tools or that the state could use? Because I'm thinking, okay, well, what about, say, the high cost of infrastructure, of rent, of all the sort of peripheral aspects that drive up the overall cost of living in this state? Could the state perhaps subsidize child care centers on those fronts and then hopefully bring down the cost or level the cost for families paying?
Absolutely. In fact, I actually think that's something that should definitely be considered. When you look at programs in Massachusetts and what they're spending their resources on, the number one expense is staffing. The second biggest expense is space. And as we know, in Massachusetts, space is expensive, particularly compared to the rest of the country. And childcare can't just go in anywhere. It needs a space that's well-maintained. It needs to be large. It needs to have adequate ventilation, windows. It needs to have infrastructure in terms of plumbing, sinks. Ideally, it needs outdoor space for children to play. And all these things really come at a high cost.
Mm. But what about for the family side? I mean, should there be a greater direct subsidy to families who are in need of early childhood education and childcare?
Yes. I mean, in Massachusetts, we do offer subsidies for our lowest income families. There's also programs such as Head Start available to those families. And families in the higher income range typically can afford to buy high quality care. It's really those working class families in the middle who don't have access to subsidies and who really can't afford to buy high quality care that we really need to focus on in terms of policy.
Right. Well, my last question for you links back to this idea that I started the whole conversation with. The New America Foundation report suggests that we have a K through 12 education system which is funded by it's publicly funded, and we have this separate, you know, early childhood education system, which does not operate in the same market, even though we have similar expectations of what it should provide. So, I mean, is one of the ways out of this this cost versus a quality problem that we should just expand what we think of as K through 12, you know, to pre-K or pre-K through 12, and just treat it all the same?
Well, I certainly think that is definitely one strategy to take. Certainly, the Boston Public Schools has aggressively expanded their public pre-K program over the years. It's quite large and provides early education to many children in Boston. I think that that's something certainly that can be thought of at a district level as well as state level.
And so what would you do? What's your preferred policy prescription then?
Well, I think we actually need to take a multi-pronged approach. I think we need to look at expanding subsidies for working class families. I think we need to raise the reimbursement rate for programs serving subsidized kids. I also think we need to think of alternatives like subsidies to programs for space and alternatives for space to help reduce some of those costs.
Well, Joanne Roberts is Senior Research Scientist at the Work, Families, and Children Research Group at the Wellesley Centers for Women. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've got a link to the New America Foundation report at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
The thing that left my hands shaking was that those I had known, particularly my grandmother, we were so close, but she didn't tell me the truth.
I think there comes a time in almost everyone's life where we're suddenly confronted by an unavoidable, disquieting fact. We do not know everything about those we love the most, and the things we do not know about them could be very devastating. Julie Lindahl faced this moment several years ago. She wrote about it in her memoir, The Pendulum, In Search of Truth, and also for WBUR's Cognoscenti page.
It's very difficult to swallow because you think you're very close to a person and yet they haven't told you the truth about something very, very serious.
Lindahl's grandfather was a Nazi, a high-ranking officer who'd committed terrible crimes. That was the secret her beloved grandmother had been hiding from Lindahl for much of her childhood. You see, Julie Lindahl was born in Brazil, where her grandparents had fled at the end of World War II. And when she was a little girl, Lindahl had been told that her grandfather was simply a land manager in Poland during the Third Reich. Sitting at her grandmother's knee, Lindahl says there were obvious signs, though. Yes, signs that there was more to her family's story than was being let on. For example, her grandmother denied the Holocaust and would only refer to Jews in hushed tones.
So I think that's the thing that was hardest to handle and continues to be difficult to handle. But I handle it better now.
So decades later, Julie Lindahl could no longer bear the burden of what she calls her inherited guilt. She needed to know the truth. So she undertook a 6-year journey through Germany and Poland, deep into national archives and face-to-face interviews.
Of course, when you start to do that kind of thing, you're going to lose people. Because, and this is true for any serious family secret, I'm sure a lot of people listening will be able to identify with this, that if you try to go into your family's past and investigate things that no one wants to talk about, there are people you will lose. And at that point in time, I was very frightened of that. And in some ways, you know, there were many moments walking towards those archives where I thought, you can still turn around. You can still, you know, there's still a chance for you. Even one of my very good friends who actually was Jewish and had escaped Germany during the 30s said to me, you know, do you really need to do this? And for me, the answer was yes.
At the German Federal Archives, Julie Lindahl found papers that confirmed her suspicion. Her grandfather was a Nazi and a member of the SS, and he wasn't just a land manager. He was Special Führer for Landed Estates in East Prussia and Poland. He was the officer in charge of converting Poland into the breadbasket of the Third Reich.
Now, in his case, it's correct that he was involved with taking over the land and making it productive for the Reich. But his task was not planting carrots and potatoes. It turns out that his task was actually deportation, enslavement, torture, and actually murder of the local population in order to accomplish this task. I was also presented with the argument eventually when I actually confronted my grandmother with this information. The argument was made that he had to follow orders. This is a common argument that's made. Mm-hmm. But very soon I learned that these people were given, they were pumped full of propaganda, sent out, and they were given free rein over the domains over which they governed. And, you know, his fanaticism let loose. So that's what I learned about him.
I do have to ask you, Julie, that you you said that you had spoken, and part of your research took you to actually speaking to some people who had been victims of your grandfather. Mm-hmm. And that in your Cognoscenti piece, you wrote that understandably there were people who did not want to speak to you. But can you tell me what it was like when you sat down in conversation with those who were willing to talk with you?
Hmm. You know, all these people that I followed up with were, they weren't wealthy people, put it that way. They were people with little means living out in the Polish countryside. One of them was a very nice man who had a great big scar over his eye, and he was very intent on telling me, you know, everything he could remember, because he could see that I needed it, and in some ways maybe he needed it too, because who else would be interested in this story? Who else would remember? Who else would want to talk about it? Nobody around him wanted to remember that time. And maybe for somebody who was 83 or 85, I can't remember exactly how old he was, it was important to sit down and have this conversation. The thing that was very hard to learn was that the scar over his eye had actually been, was actually as a result of my grandfather beating him when he was a kid, because he hadn't removed his cap when the SS passed by him. So if you were a Pole, you had to lift your cap when the SS passed. Actually, I have to thank this person, because he looked me hard in the eye and said, you know, this wasn't your fault, so you have to let go of that. And I must say I'm indebted to him for that, because it was from that moment on that I was actually able to do something productive with this.
He gave you permission to do something productive with that. At that moment when he said that, how did you feel? I mean, because you write about how you had felt the inner plague of the bystander.
Yes.
And did his compassion to you lift that burden?
Well, it doesn't lift the burden of responsibility that I feel, not responsibility for what people did in the past, but the responsibility I have to stand up, to speak about the truth, and to speak about what I see today and how I see it, having been through 6 years of this and really a lifetime of thinking about this.
Now, families don't like to talk about their dark legacies. After all, that is what launched Julie Lindahl on her journey in the first place anyway. But Lindahl says she'll speak because, quote, history had become the mirror of ourselves, she writes in her WBUR Cognoscenti essay. She says, in the shouting of demagogues across Europe and the United States who use the opportunity of a refugee crisis to justify their underlying racism and thirst for power, Julie Lindahl hears her grandfather's shouting.
We have a crisis in the world erupting. At that time, it was communism. Now we have a refugee crisis. We have a counter-reaction, which is fear. People go looking for scapegoats and blame them. At that time, it was Jews who were suddenly Bolsheviks. Now it's Muslims who are terrorists. And the demagogues and the far right and the dictators all take advantage of this situation and, create a sort of polarization society and violence, ultimately leading to war. So I see those things, and there are historians who say we shouldn't make those comparisons, but history doesn't repeat itself, but human behaviors repeat themselves.
Right. I mean, I was going to just ask you about that, because you do mention Donald Trump in your Cognoscenti piece, and there are many people who would say it's not it is nowhere near the same right now, the Trump candidacy, as what happened in pre-war and wartime Germany. That we're mistaken in even thinking that this is an appropriate time to look back at that history. And I wonder what your further response is to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that history gets very misused. Hitler gets bandied around as Trump is Hitler and so on. And of course, this is incorrect. It's not true. There are very, very big differences between anyone who gets called Hitler today and Hitler. But I think, once again, we have to look at patterns of human behavior and ask ourselves whether we have, in fact, progressed. And I must say that the scaremongering that has come out of that campaign does bear similarities to the past. Mm-hmm. And there's no denying that, you know, you'd have to be crazy not to see that.
You know, Julie, I'm thinking about your investigation and your journey and the 6 years that you spent uncovering all that you did. And it feels to me like, you pretty much said it. You did it because you felt you had no choice, right? Your mm-hmm. life demanded that you do this. But it was also very hard. I mean, it's really, really hard work. It's hard, psychologically, emotionally. And the vast number of the rest of us don't have that same motivation, right, to undertake mm-hmm. this hard work of facing history. How mm-hmm. might we find the encouragement and motivation to do so?
Mm-hmm. Well, just look at the world today. That must be a sufficient motivation. The world is on a bad path. We all know that. We're in a much more dangerous position than we were a decade ago or a couple of decades ago. I think that should be a sufficient motivation for people to start to look carefully, not only at, the history that I've looked at, but also the history of our own families. If you look deeply into your own family, you'll always find somebody or a group of people who were involved in something that was violent and terrible and so forth. One person I know looked into her family and found that it was the largest slave trading family in the United States. Mm-hmm. And she went and faced that. And did it well. But I really think that people need to ask themselves whether they'd like the current developments in the world to continue. And if they don't want that to happen, then they should start to look back and they should start to examine world history and their own family's history very, very carefully.
Well, Julie Lindahl is the author of the memoir The Pendulum, In Search of Truth. She's also written a piece for WBUR's Cognoscenti titled The Mirror of Ourselves, Facing History in Order Not to Repeat It. Julie, thank you so much for sharing your story and your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hillary Clinton is in New Hampshire today, one of the key states that could decide the outcome of the presidential election in November. Clinton is at the University of New Hampshire, Durham, and here's what she said just moments ago.
Indeed, here in New Hampshire, we've got so many young people graduating with debt who aren't able to get started in their careers, aren't able to do the jobs like I could do, because they have to get a job that pays as much as possible to begin paying their debt down. So we should, and we will, make public colleges tuition-free for families earning less than $125,000 a year.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is at the Clinton rally in Durham and joins us now. Anthony, what's it like up there in the room?
Well, hi, Meghna. It's going on right now, and Bernie Sanders gave a speech, Hillary Clinton gave a speech, and you played a piece from that. And what's happening right now is there's a bit of a panel going on that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are participating in, answering questions about college debt and how to deal with it. And one of her big thrusts here today is to talk about this new college compact, the plan that would eliminate the cost of in-state public college tuition for families earning less than $125,000. So that's the focus here today, focusing on young people in New Hampshire.
All right, so we'll talk about those young people more in just a second, but a couple of polls this month have Clinton up in New Hampshire by anywhere from 9 to 2 points. I mean, much closer than it was earlier in the race. Why is it so close now?
Well, this is the question that I think everyone wants to answer. And of course, this is what the Clinton campaign is keenly aware of. You only have to go back to 2000, the 2000 election when Al Gore lost to George W. Bush in New Hampshire by just 7,000 votes. And had he won New Hampshire, that whole Florida recount thing wouldn't have happened. And the Clinton folks are keenly aware of that. And that's why they're in New Hampshire. You know, you look at the current map of the Electoral College, and a lot of folks are predicting that this could be very, very close. And it could indeed come down to 4 electoral votes in New Hampshire. And so they're not taking any chances. This was a state that they thought they had in the bag, but it's now considered a toss-up state. And so they're doing everything they can. And what they're trying to do is to focus on the youth vote in a big way, because that's a key part of the coalition that Clinton hopes to put together to win this state and
right.
the presidency.
Well, so as you mentioned, part of that that coalition means bringing Bernie Sanders in for this rally. He spoke just before Clinton, and here's a little bit about what he said.
All of you know that New Hampshire is a battleground state. All of you know that this is a very tight election, and in fact, New Hampshire could decide the outcome. So I am asking you here today not only to vote for Secretary Clinton, but to work hard to get your friends to vote.
So Bernie Sanders, they're talking to young people and their friends. I mean, Anthony, Sanders won by a huge margin in the New Hampshire primary in February, especially amongst college-age voters. He won 83% of 18 to 29-year-olds in New Hampshire who voted for a Democratic candidate. Clinton only took 16%. So she's got a huge mountain to climb with young New Hampshire Democrats. How is she trying to reach them?
Yeah, she really does. And there are a couple more figures that sort of tell the story, Magna. Obama had more than 60% of young voters in 2008 and 2012. Clinton is currently polling at about 40% among young voters. So this is why she's bringing in Bernie Sanders, because as you said, Sanders reached about 80% of them. So she's really hoping that she can sort of catch Sanders lightning in a bottle, if you will, and really energize these younger voters. And how she's trying to do it is wrapped up with this message today. You know, they're focusing on student indebtedness. And I talked to students before this event, and this is an issue that resonates with a lot of them. Lots of kids are graduating with tens of thousands of dollars in student debt. And Hillary Clinton, you know, by bringing this issue that Bernie Sanders very much made a central issue in his campaign, the idea of free public college tuition, is, you know, she's hoping that's the way she's going to energize these voters. But so far, if you look at the polling anyway, she's got some work to do among younger voters.
Yeah. Well, just to underscore how important New Hampshire is, Donald Trump is expected to be in Bedford, New Hampshire tomorrow. But is he going after the same young voters that it seems Clinton is aggressively courting today?
No, I think Donald Trump is really focusing on, essentially white male voters, really shoring up that key constituency that is firmly behind him, or that definitely represents the constituency that's behind him in the biggest way. Of course, he wants to expand that. I talked to a young man in Peterborough earlier today. He was 20. This will be the first time he's voting. He said he was definitely voting for Donald Trump. And when I asked him why, he said, change. That's the only reason. Talked to another person in that same mall in Peterborough, slightly older gentleman, who said he's voting for Donald Trump. And what was interesting about him is he had been a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Huh.
And I asked what unites Trump and Sanders, and he used the same word. It's change. So that's what Trump is trying to tap into. This is a time
yeah.
and a moment in America where a lot of people want to see change, and Hillary Clinton might not be regarded by them as a change agent.
Well, that's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks in Durham, New Hampshire. Anthony, thanks.
It's always a pleasure, Magna.
We'd like to send out a hearty congratulations to Gloucester author Deborah Kramer. She just won this year's National Academies of Sciences Communication Award for her book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. We spoke with Deborah Kramer last year when her book first came out, and tonight we'd like to share that conversation once again with you. The bird is the red knot, a small shorebird that weighs less than a coffee cup. The ancient crab is the horseshoe crab, a creature that's lived basically unchanged on this earth for 450 million years. The two animals are intimately connected, and human beings are interfering with that connection, and we talked with Deborah about that. But first, we thought we'd start with the third part of this story, the epic journey. Because each year, the little red knot takes wing on an astonishing migration, an almost 20,000-mile round-trip journey from the southern tip of Argentina, north to the Arctic, then back. Deborah Kramer followed the birds, so before we jump into the rest of our conversation, let's just listen to Deborah and imagine in our mind's eyes the fantastic flight of the red knot, beginning in Tierra del Fuego.
It's a remote beach on the Strait of Magellan. There's about 64-mile length of beach, and the tide goes out about 7 miles. It's the only place where I've ever stood at the edge of the sea at low tide and not been able to see the water. We waited and waited, and then in the distance we could see what looked like a whiff of smoke. I actually did think it was smoke. And then as the tide came in, the birds started coming in with the tide, and the whiff of smoke got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was thousands of shorebirds coming in to eat with the tide. It was beautiful. From there, some of them go to a place called Las Grutas in Argentina. It's a developing resort, so the birds are competing for space on the beach with a lot of bathers, ATVs. Some of those beaches are very crowded.
Right.
I also visited them in the Laguna Madre of Texas, which is one of the most heavily human-designed bodies of water around, and yet there are birds there.
So in my mind's eye, I'm sort of seeing the map of the world, the Western Hemisphere, from the Arctic to the United States, Central America, and South America, and I'm trying to draw that little dotted line that the birds follow.
Right, well, then you would continue up to James Bay, and then up to a little island called Southampton Island, just below the Arctic Circle. And there was a tiny bird in Delaware Bay at the same time I was, and this bird beat me up to the Arctic. It apparently flew through a major storm that grounded all of us on Baffin Island, where we waited and waited and waited. So we stayed in Baffin Island while this bird navigated this.
Was summer. It tagged? Is that how you knew?
Yes, okay. It had a little tag on it with a number.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the other thing about it was freezing up there. And the birds were walking around in the snow, and we were all wearing every single piece of clothing we had.
And still feeling very
and
cold.
And still feeling very cold.
The hardy little red knot. From Argentina to the Arctic, almost 20,000 miles there and back again. Flying across continents and through blizzards, you can imagine how tough their journey is. Deborah Kramer says that's why, about 3/4 of the way into their northerly migration, the red knots make a very important stop, Delaware Bay. And they time it perfectly. Once a year, in late spring, when the water warms, at high tide during the full and new moons, hundreds of thousands of ancient horseshoe crabs crawl ashore to lay their eggs. And in an astonishing act of synchronicity that's been going on for thousands of years, this is when the red knots arrive, to eat the eggs, fatten up, and power north to the Arctic.
And one night I went out. It was a full moon night.
Otherwise, it was very dark. And it was about 12 o'clock, I think. I went out onto this beach, and there was nobody else there. And the beach is completely quiet. I was there, I don't know, probably about 20 minutes, 25 minutes before high tide. And then the crabs started coming in, thousands of them. So you could stand on the beach, and in either direction, as far as you can see, they're all lined up with the tide coming in. And they're laying their eggs in the sand, and then they go back. And 30 minutes after high tide, they're gone. So if you come an hour earlier or an hour later, you miss the entire thing. Then the next day, I went to another beach, which was covered with shorebirds, thousands of them, scurrying around as fast as they possibly could. They were thin, they were hungry, and they were in a hurry. But there were so many of them that you couldn't even see the sand.
So you can see just how closely the red knots, and many other shorebirds for that matter, are connected to the horseshoe crab. They come together, down from the sky and up from the water, just once a year. The crabs lay their eggs, the birds eat just what they need. Then they go their separate ways. And as we said, this has been happening for thousands of years. Deborah Kramer says the delicate balance, though, it's at risk because of, you guessed it, us, human interference.
Horseshoe crabs are incredibly resilient animals, and there's always been quite a few of them. But humans have always had an interest in horseshoe crabs. In the second half of the 19th century, they took millions of them out of the water and turned them into fertilizer and managed to deplete large numbers of them. Synthetic fertilizers came in, and then the crabs recovered. What's happened more recently is that there's been a growing interest in using horseshoe crabs for bait. Mm. This is unnecessary for a number of reasons, but that depressed the number of horseshoe crabs substantially, so that the birds, usually 90% of them, would gain the weight they needed to get to the Arctic and successfully breed. And around by 2002, I think only a third of them were.
Wow.
So the population started dropping, and a number of people who were watching the birds and advocating for the protection of the birds figured out that it was the horseshoe crab that actually needed to be protected in order to protect the bird. And that started years of regulation, which may or may not be adequate even now.
Hmm. Every horseshoe crab that's caught for bait dies, right?
Right.
So obviously that's had a profound impact on the population. But there's also another
use.
Remarkable use for the crabs that science has found.
The crab is an amazing animal. In the 1950s, a scientist discovered that horseshoe crab blood clots in the presence of toxins that are released by certain kinds of bacteria. It took many years to isolate that quality and turn it into a test which was approved by the FDA that basically looks for those toxins in all the vaccines that we have, all of the IV antibiotics that we have, chemotherapies that we have, any drugs that are administered into the bloodstream, the 500,000 heart stents that are implanted in people every year, hip replacements, knee replacements, all of these things don't give us raging infections because the horseshoe crab blood test makes sure that they don't have any endotoxin on them.
So, Deborah, what you're saying is millions of people have the horseshoe crab to thank for the cleanliness or sterility of what's been put into their bodies.
And I would say your pets as well.
Okay. But we should say, though, that unlike the horseshoe crabs who are caught for bait, all of them die. The mortality rate for horseshoe crabs that are taken for this product is significantly less, right?
It is significantly less. the regulators are assuming that 15% of them die. There are some studies which show it's actually closer to 20 or 25%.
You know, as a rule, I really shouldn't give my opinion on things, but I am going to give my opinion on this, that it astonishes me that this 400-million-year-old creature, this ancient being, is still the primary source of this cutting-edge biomedical process equipment. I don't know what we're going to call it, but the reality of that is amazing to me.
Well, this animal, when you think about it, is amazingly resilient. There have been 5 mass extinctions on this planet, and the horseshoe crab has survived all of them, including the one that killed 97% of marine life. And I'm not surprised in some ways that we haven't been able to replicate it. This is a unique animal that deserves an amazing amount of reverence and respect.
Why does understanding the relationship between these two animals, why does it matter to us?
There are utilitarian reasons why we would like to keep all these animals here. One of them has to do with the LAL test that the horseshoe crab provides us. For the birds, I think that it's very difficult for us to make economic analysis of what is valuable and what isn't valuable. I don't think that we can really anticipate what the losses are going to be, yet over and over again, we start feeling consequences when we wipe out birds. Mm. And the book has lots of examples of those. There are millions and millions of birds, and they add a great deal of beauty to our lives, and I think they would be diminished if they were gone.
So you also call the red knot a 21st century canary in the coal mine. What could it be ringing the alarm for?
They make this long journey. They're taking the measure of the edge of 2 whole continents, because how they manage in one place is affected by whether their lives are diminished or enhanced in another. So when they're all done, we have a sense of the health of the edge of these 2 continents. How well they can thrive there has implications for us, even if it's not directly related to the birds themselves. So for example, we've talked about how they need the crabs and we need the crabs. The birds also eat clams and mussels in other places along the route. We eat a lot of shellfish, and all of these shellfish are going to be threatened. They're already being threatened by the increasing acidification of the ocean. Thirdly, their homes at the edge of the sea are getting eroded away. The sea's going to come in. We aren't going to really be able to stop it.
Ever more every year.
Right, and if the edge of the sea is a healthy place for them, it can be a healthy place for us.
Well, on that note, Deborah, before I let you go, there's one more thing I really have to ask. Because you live in Gloucester, right?
Yes.
After taking this epic journey with the red knot, did it make you look around Gloucester or Cape Ann differently?
Of course.
How so?
It's almost embarrassing to say this, but I've lived along the marshes of Gloucester for a long time now. And I've spent years out there on Cranes Beach. And I have to say, I never saw these birds. So I came home and we went out early one September and we paddled out to a little stand of marsh grass and we walked along the mud and stood behind the grass, and on the other side, water was coming up and the birds were coming in. And there were several juvenile red knots. They'd been up in the Arctic when I was there, and they were on their way to Cerro del Fuego, and there they were in my backyard.
Amazing. Deborah, thank you so much.
Magna, thank you.
Deborah Kramer's book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey, came out last year. Kramer just won a National Academies of Sciences Communication Award for her book. For an excerpt along with beautiful photos of her epic journey, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Thank you.